LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
January 6th hearings, the real heroes and the real villains, an update on gun control and the Supreme Court, with AOC weighing in, and Joe Biden for President 2024. An update right now on this uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
We're in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage, and I can see through these guys.
Welcome back to The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. I'm your host, Scott Cosenza, and joining me today is LibertyNation.com senior political analyst and my friend, Mr. Tim Donner. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Hello, Scott. Good to be back.
Has the market affected the price of champagne and caviar to the point that you're sufficiently aware of the economic crisis in America these days, or are we still waiting on that?
Well, being a member of the New York Donners, we study these things on a regular basis. It's a rolling average from day to day.
I appreciate
it's
that.
It's distributed to everyone in the family so we know which specific brand of non-Russian caviar to purchase.
The scandal.
Let me make clear: we do not buy Putin-produced caviar.
Let nobody say that these things haven't hit you the hardest, Tim. I can't even imagine. And for you to have the courage to come and speak publicly about that, I just want to say bravo. And we continue our celebration of Pride Week or Pride Month, rather, here on the Uprising, Tim. The celebration just continues apace and.
It's amazing. You cannot get away from it. I mean, it's remarkable. Everywhere you turn is pride, 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 pride.
I think maybe that's the pendulum having reached its apex on the other side of this is so ridiculous now that, you know, I'm sure they're selling rainbow stamps at the post office. And if you go to buy a Gatorade, it's probably rainbow
everything.
Pride.
Everything,
Gatorade,
everything you buy. Yeah. Everywhere you go, everywhere you look, every internet site, every Prime Video, Netflix, wherever you go, wherever you buy stuff, whether it be Amazon or elsewhere,
you're saying if there's anything left on the shelves,
yeah,
it's going
or
to
whatever's
be,
left, yes.
It's going to be.
A lot's been withheld from the shelves. So that they can add the pride flag to the product.
All right. Well, let's go ahead
to get it to the stores in time to hit, you know, the middle to end of Pride Month.
This is the second to the last Uprising podcast during Pride Month. So,
that's notable.
We only have one more to get all that pride out, Tim, which we're going to do. But let's turn our attention.
Well, you've already declared yourself a white supremacist.
No, that's just.
You said white pride.
I can't celebrate black pride. I'm not black or person of or POC pride, as I'm not a POC, Tim. I'm a white guy. So I have to celebrate white pride. That's the prison gang mentality that I always want to talk about because that's what
isn't then the presumption
if we are.
Isn't the presumption of Pride Month that you and me being white heterosexual men.
I love that you call me white, and that's so great. When did I get this promo?
We're proud of that we're white, that we're heterosexual, and that we're a man. Okay. There's the assumption that we're proud of that. So they're saying, well, we're proud of what we are too. I'm not, like you said, these are immutable characteristics. How can you be proud of something that's an immutable characteristic? It's how you were born. Isn't that what gay people have said? They were born that way. Well, fine. Then why are you either proud or ashamed? You shouldn't be ashamed, but you shouldn't be proud.
Now you're actually making me defend the pride March's stuff, because when it started, there was a good reason for it.
Right. But
you couldn't be a member of sort of polite society. And it was scandalous to be a gay person. Right.
Right. So, I understand. What I'm saying is what they demand in reality is something they should get. But it's not pride. It's respect. Yeah. They should be respected for the human beings that they are, created by God, by like all the rest of us. But pride puts it in the category of trying to say, well, it's the wrong kind of pride to me.
Well, I mean, I think that we're debating about angels on a head of a pin here, because what you are talking about is that's a 30 year ago thing. We're now to the point where this is just like, it's like when 4th of July comes up and every business in the world's got their American flag out. Not in the world, in America, of course, has their American flag out. Like somehow it's patriotic to go buy a window air conditioner, you know, on July 4th weekend, as opposed to what it's not, you know, I mean, it's absolutely preposterous, right? They're just wrapping themselves in whatever the colors of the day are to sell a widget.
So I have an associated question for you quickly.
Go ahead.
What do you think, what, if any, form of celebration should conservatives and libertarians have on Juneteenth? Because it's become a left-wing holiday.
Yeah, I think they should totally co-opt it. I think they should totally co-opt it. I think we should move into the space. It's a natural space for conservatives and libertarians.
I agree.
Because what it says is that we're
celebrating liberation.
Absolutely.
We're celebrating the last vestige of slavery. And I think just because the left exploits it for their own progressive purposes doesn't mean we shouldn't celebrate for what it means to our movement.
Tim, if you want to give me a day off and treat me to a fancy lunch to celebrate these things, I want to tell you that I will be there and I support that kind of a thing. All right.
Well, I'll give you, once I send you the champagne, the Daily Champagne Report, you can select which brute you prefer and then we can.
I appreciate that. Yes. All right, let's move along here. We've got a few things to talk about. Sadly, Tim, the United States Supreme Court, you know, one of my stock lines is if you expect them to disappoint you, then your expectations will be met. They have disappointed me this week massively. They've released, I think, 11 opinions this week, and none of the ones that we've been pining for, the abortion, guns, free speech, all the sexy stuff they're keeping in reserve for, I guess, to do it as they walk out the door last minute.
Yeah, probably.
So they don't have
to. Which is when? At the end of June?
Typically, it's the end of June, yeah. Right. Meaning, when I say typically, what I mean by that is the court doesn't have a calendar like Congress where it's kind of, you know, very much set in, maybe not in stone, but in something pretty hard to erase. Instead, they break when they're done, meaning when they have reported out all their cases that they're going to. Now, the justices have commitments. They have on the light side, family vacations. On the heavy side, they have like teaching commitments, overseas trips. You know, the summer of a Supreme Court justice is a pretty good summer, I think, Tim, and they want to get to it. So they're motivated to get out the
they're
door.
They're no different than us. They're just normal people, just like us.
You're going to be in coastal Spain teaching law school to a 15 student section, all of whom are, you know, well-to-do American students who revere you. It's a tough gig if you can get it, boy.
And you're going to make in six figures for doing it.
You know what? I don't think that so the money is really good. I don't think it's like, it's not like a Hillary Clinton speech to Goldman Sachs good. Okay. But it's quite good.
I like the analogy that you use. Thank you.
All right. Well, speaking of Hillary, let's get into to a little bit of politics.
Were we?
Here. I want to first talk about, Joe Biden and the presidency. And I think that, you know, we go back and forth about this, and I wonder if we're talking past each other. I want to talk about a brief message exchange we had earlier this week when I sent to you the Catherine Jean Pierre
Jean-Pierre,
excuse me.
Please. Come on, by the way, so uncivilized.
Can't go unnoticed. Not a descendant of American slavery, by the way. These Democrats keep hiring persons of color, Tim, but they refuse to hire the descendants of American slavery.
So what you're saying is she's been insufficiently oppressed.
Well, that's exactly right. Yeah, she hasn't had that. The whole point of focusing on.
So she's there with Kamala, insufficiently oppressed.
Absolutely right.
To claim true
the Indian lady
status.
From Canada, who's the vice president. Yeah, I do.
From Canada. That's great.
That's where she spent her formative years. Everybody should be. I mean, it's ridiculous that we don't talk about that, but it's like.
Well, I guarantee you, if she runs for president this time, instead of last time where she face planted right out of the box, believe me, people will talk about it.
You know, if she grew up, Tim, in like Wyoming, in the great wide open, okay, she would be all the time. They would talk about how her rural upbringing informed her and this and that, but nobody mentions the fact that she lived in Canada for her formative years. Like it's
well, how many people mentioned that Barack Obama lived in Indonesia during
but he was at least
years.
A little kid, though. A little kid when he was in Indonesia.
Okay, but that's a formative time.
Yeah, but when he got to America, he learned about American history. Kamala Harris is learning about the Queen and Canadian history in her formative years.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you can tell that she seems like a sort of a person without a country. She's sort of out there in sort of the ether. She's just like disconnected from having her feet on the ground.
I'm not going to play a disaster. Clip, but she's one of the country's greatest laughers that we have, Tim. You know that she's
I would amend that to say cacklers.
But
Hillary Clinton.
All right. I sent you the Catherine Jean-Pierre tweet. To be clear, as the president has said repeatedly, he plans to run in 2024. And then you send me a piece that I don't know if I was the germ for you to write this piece for libertynation.com, but you send me back. Yeah, right. Look what his own people are now saying. And you include a New York Times article that basically features Democrats saying, no go, Joe. We got to pick somebody new. And here
it's
was
time to leap.
Here was KJP.
Does the president have the stamina, physically and mentally, do you think, to continue on even after 2024?
Don, you're asking me this question. Oh, my gosh. He's the president of the United States. You know, I can't even keep up with it. We just got back from New Mexico. We just got back from California. That is not a question that we should be even asking. Just look at the work that he does and look what how he's delivering for the American public. Look, that article that we're talking about is hearsay. It's salacious. That's not what we care about. We care about how are we going to deliver for the American people? How are we going to make their lives better? That's what the president talks about. That is his focus. And that's where we're going to continue to focus on.
Tim, did you notice the conspicuous lack of an answer to the question posed, the direct question posed?
Well, she tried the Kamala Harris route of laughing off the question. Oh, come on. What a ridiculous question.
The first thing you should do, though, is answer
like nobody
the question.
Else is you asking say, that question.
You should say, yes, he's up to it. But the other thing, too, I just thought was hilarious is like, is there a less stress-free way to travel than literally getting up from your desk when you decide to, walking to a car that's driven by other people for which there will be 100 police officers along a motorcade stopping all other traffic. So you don't even have to stop for a single pause to go right onto the tarmac of a plane. It is challenging to negotiate those stairs up to
the,
we know that Biden trips and falls a lot when he does that. Doesn't give you any joy to report it, but besides
besides
the staircase flight to the luxury appointed 747, where there's a staff to cater to his every whim and need, including doctors and everybody else on call. Like the idea that The idea that it's particularly rigorous to travel to California
but to New Mexico, this is what the president is doing,
that's the ultimate test, Tim. He's able to handle the top of the top drawer imagined luxury travel in the world.
They're trying to pass off this guy as really engaged and involved, and he's traveling all over the place, where by all accounts, he's challenged. Let's just put it charitably. He's challenged to meet the requirements of the job. And the, you know, the biggest problem, Scott, is that, you know, the name Jimmy Carter's come up a lot lately because he was the last disgraced, inept, incompetent,
because
Democratic president.
Because of stagflation, Tim. The unique presence of reduced economic growth and increased inflation, which became president
under Jimmy Carter. But here's the thing. Jimmy Carter, for all his ineptitude and his infamy for being like the worst president, one of the worst presidents in American history, he was young, he was energetic, he was truly intelligent, and he did do some good things, including deregulatory policies, which were carried over.
Carter, deregulatory?
Now, Jimmy, yes, he did. He did do deregulation, which was not terribly publicized.
I'll be looking forward to your In Defense of Jimmy Carter piece to appear
well,
on
I'm comparing
LibertyNation.com.
No, but here's what I'm going to... Wait a minute. You have to let me finish.
Go ahead.
Because I'm not saying Carter was a good president. What I'm saying is, compared to Biden, at least with Carter, there was some hope because of the fact he was young and energetic and smart, that things that he could figure it out. With Biden is in decline. There's no hope that he can reverse his neurological deficiencies. So it can only get worse for him. So it's Graham Noble put together my favorite subtitle of the year for a piece I wrote saying that basically what I just said here, which is that, you know, if he thinks that Carter was bad, well, Biden doesn't even come to the Carter level. So Graham Noble put in the subtitle, Joe Biden, comma, you are no Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
Which I thought was the subtitle of the year.
Too, is he's had 41 years of post-presidency to rehabilitate his presidency. What I mean, he's the only president for 4 years, and the last 41 years, with the exception of his typical flirting with anti-Semitic tropes occasionally, he's been a stellar ex-president with his...
He's 97.
With his Habitat for Humanity, which... Yeah. Almost does enough to cover for the shambles of what his presidency did to the U.S. economy. I remember it well. I was a very young person, but I remember how bad it was during Carter.
It was terrible.
And
a lot of people got destroyed by the high interest rates. Adjustable rate mortgages were the death of a lot of people because the teaser rate was 5%, 6%, and it would adjust as high as 19 or 20. And people got bankrupted during that period of time. So it was in the malaise speech and the sense that, you know, somehow it was our fault.
Well, let's bring it right back around to present day. And here's what Carter didn't have. And, you know, I want to be kind of circumspect about talking about this a lot, because I think part of it is a little bit not the highest order of analysis, but it can't be ignored, I think. Which is the president's decline, the president's lack of being a sharp thinker, which I think is, you know,
right.
You want a person with a good character, I would hope. And a person who understands the moving parts the best they can be, and also somebody who's sharp.
But here's the thing.
With the president.
With Jimmy Carter, you could understand if the job overwhelmed him, as it did. He wasn't up to it. But he was coming from being governor of Georgia. So that, to some degree, was
predictable. In 76, by the way, which, you know, it was hardly... in terms of the size of the economy of Georgia, it's not a.
As compared to a guy, Joe Biden, who was in the Senate for six terms for like 36 years and vice president for 8 years, you'd think there's no excuse for him to be this clueless and incompetent. A guy like Carter or a guy like Clinton or Reagan, who were governors who didn't have any federal experience, you can understand a period of adjustment that was needed. But now, here we are, 16 months into this guy's presidency after he's been in Washington for his whole life. And the New York Times has just said, give up on him. Shove the old man aside.
Yeah.
Well, they've given permission. The
here he is on
Bible.
Here he is on Kimmel, so bad off script that Kimmel has to dump the commercial like he's dealing with a person not in charge of their faculties.
No question.
So there's
about
a lot of major things we've done. But what we haven't done is we haven't been able to communicate it in a way that is. Let me say another way.
Well, see, that's kind of perfect. Yeah. Well, we haven't been able to communicate
but
it.
But look how the press has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Look how the press has
changed. It has changed. Oh, listen, I get it.
I know you overstand it.
Yeah.
You don't just understand it, you overstand it. But here's the deal. One of the things is that it's very difficult now to have a, even with notable exceptions, even the really good reporters, they have to get the number of clicks on nightly news.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of asking a question, anyway, it just, everything gets sensationalized in ways that, but I'm convinced we can get through this. We have to get through it. And one of the things, look,
I'm going to take a break, and then we'll talk a little bit more, if you don't mind.
You.
I'm sorry. We have some of those commercials. We have some biracial commercials we need to show.
That's actually a good line. I don't blame you. That's his best line.
He doesn't present himself well. I think, to have to dump to commercial because of his rambling. And so I'll go back to what I said before, which is, you keep putting out these things that say that X, Y, and Z, like the New York Times piece, those people aren't going to support Joe Biden. I'm not talking about what every other Democrat in the world is going to do. I'm talking that somehow or another, by hook or by crook, Joe Biden is going to be able to complete that federal filing that says, I am running for president of the United States for the next cycle. And he is running, sir. He is running for president. You tell me I'm crazy. Tell me that's not going to happen.
What that is, Scott, is the default position that any president would take. Because if only for this, that if he says he's not, he becomes a lame duck immediately and loses all of his power.
So let me ask you a question. Just stop for a second. Let me ask you a question. Is it? Is it A or B? Is it A, reflex, that like from the moment they start, they just always say, yes, I'm running? Or is it B, a considered, like you say, I'm not running, but also I can't say that I'm not running because I don't want to have my knees cut out from under me and be a lame duck?
I think for Biden, it's A. Everyone else, it's B. In other words, everyone else can see what perhaps he won't see or can't see, which is that he's just, it's all falling apart for him. And the question is whether he'll be the last one to see it.
Right. Okay, let's turn our attention briefly here. We'll talk about the Supreme Court security bill, which did pass the House finally. I think there were 27 Democrats who voted against it. And just
incredible.
To be clear, this bill does not provide for anything other than the authority for Supreme Court security officers to also protect justices' immediate family members. So right now, these security officers, they have the legal authority to police to the benefit of the security of those justices, but it doesn't also include their family members when they're not with them. So when Kavanaugh goes to work, or when Amy Coney Barrett is at the court chambers, and the Ruth Sent Us scum of the earth people who want to target Amy Coney Barrett's children's, tiny children, their schools, to indicate their displeasure. Like that's, oh man, I didn't even plan on going on this rant, but like, if you just think about the mechanics of this, like that these people get respect in the mainstream newsrooms, like somehow it's an okay thing to address your complaint about a 50-year-old Supreme Court justice to her 6-year-old child at their place of schooling. Like that's an appropriate place. Or the alternative is that it is an absolute threat, but we're not treating it like that. Like that's not how the universe is treating it. Well, we know what it's about, and it's really disgusting. And there's no funding part of this bill. There's really nothing in the bill, Tim, that you can object to, except for here's what you can object to. If you didn't get what you want on something else, then you're not going to let the Supreme Court justices be content that their families are being well protected by people who would try to murder them. And that's what these 20, I think, seven Democrats the squad is leading the charge. And here we have the queen of the squad, AOC, Tim, indicating why she refuses to vote for Supreme Court security.
Okay, we're running. We're running. We're running. Oh, my God.
All right, so boom. I'm going to try to tell you all the unanimous consent story from earlier today where you saw me running up the Capitol steps to stop the bad things from happening. So today's a flyout day. Cool, awesome. Flyout days are where members of Congress return to their communities, do community events, town halls, etc. We have the Puerto Rican Day Parade on Sunday, for example. But flyout days are also days of maximum hijinks from party leadership, both Democratic and Republican party leadership. And the reason for that is that everyone's in a rush to get home so they can force deeply unpopular things to happen. Now, I wake up this morning and I start to hear murmurs that there's going to be an attempt to pass the Supreme Court supplemental protection bill. The day after gun safety legislation for schools and kids and people is stalled. Oh, so we can pass protections for us and here easily, right? But we can't pass protections for everyday people? I think not. So I'm going to need a roll call vote on that. Because not only are you going to try to pass it, they're trying to pass it by unanimous consent so that it can slip on by with no one's name put on it. And that's not what unanimous consent is for. Unanimous consent is not to pass things quickly to hide and prevent a politically difficult moment. If we're going to do it, let's do it. Put our name on it. Vamos. Put it on the floor.
Vamos, Tim. Vamos.
What is it? Let me play back something here.
To hide and prevent a politically difficult moment.
How is it politically difficult?
All right, you're 1,000% right. Yeah.
How is it politically difficult to say we're going to protect the families of Supreme Court justices? Am I missing, Scott?
She's combined two things. One, which is true, like it's true that oftentimes they want to package together some unpalatable stuff so that and use the time pressure of Congress critters wanting to get out the door to get through some less than palatable legislation. But this isn't it. It passed unanimously in the United States Senate.
Right. That's the point.
And was brought up for unanimous consent in the House because all politics aside, there is just nothing objectionable in this legislation.
Let me put it this way. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren voted for this bill.
Yeah.
But AOC couldn't see her way clear, along with the 25 others. The one thing I'll tell you about those 25 others is I pretty much guarantee you that the great bulk of them, if not all of them, are in safe seats. Because if you take a position like that in a competitive district, you'll be savaged for it.
Some high percentage of them are from New Jersey too. It's kind of weird. Like it's like the entire New Jersey Democrat congressional delegation decided to vote no on it. And you're right. They're not in competitive seats. It is an indefensible no vote on its own. Now, AOC obviously thinks that it's okay to defend it because she didn't get some other legislation passed that she wanted to. Therefore, it's okay to, you know, not increase the Supreme Court security because it didn't pass some gun bill. Now I have right, managed.
It's just another political football.
I've managed to call together. You know, we did have, it was just a week ago that we had the assassination attempt of Brett Kavanaugh and presumably his family. It seems doubtful that the murderer to be would have let his children and wife live while he was murdering Kavanaugh. But in any case, I've called together a rundown of the Sunday talk shows and what they presented in terms of, you know, this issue and the Supreme Court security. And let's go ahead and listen to the sort of like a hodgepodge of those clips. You listening to it?
Don't have it yet.
Oh, you have, that's it. That's the entirety of it. That's all the minutes of talk that the Sunday shows put into the attempted assassination. Oh,
that's great. That's
by the way, and it wasn't like
they, for that again. You did that before. I fell for it again.
And it wasn't like they stopped this guy in California because of some internet postings. The guy was in front of the justice's home, 15 feet from the guy's front door. I mean,
well, what would you expect from a media that refused to even acknowledge the Hunter Biden laptop, which they knew to be real?
See,
they
now we're going to get deplatformed.
They buried the story.
You said the word laptop and Hunter Biden in the same sentence. We can't. We're going to get kicked off of all the media. All right. Well, so AOC was on about guns. That's what she was about. And I just want to talk a minute about gun control and, you know, red flag laws, I think, are one of the big things that the senatorial deal seemed to go ahead and approve of, the John Cornyn deal that was reported on Sunday. You know, they don't have actual language that they've agreed on, but they've agreed in principle to support these things. And one of them is these red flag laws. And the reason why red flag laws are not acceptable is because they don't appreciate the fundamental right to keep and bear arms, by and large. And they remove due process protections for people to hold on to their guns by, instead of coming at them criminally, coming at them as like a sort of a civil type of court action, which requires only a preponderance of the evidence, which is a 50% plus one standard, rather than beyond a reasonable doubt, which is typically how, when the state removes fundamental rights for people, like putting them in jail, they have to do so beyond a reasonable doubt. And the other thing that it does is it doesn't include protections for people who will use this either A, that they are mistaken, or B, that they are using the law to their advantage. And I don't talk about this very often, but, you know, I was an attorney in abuse court, in the family courts for a short time, where I represented women who were victims of abuse. But not all of them, Tim. Every once in a while, you'd have a woman who was not a victim of abuse, who was lying about it because of the advantage it would give her in custody proceedings, in order just to damage her former partner, who she was scorned by or otherwise upset with, and just wanted to basically nuke them, legally speaking, and use the courts to do it, to take their children away from them, take their money away from them, and make them be pariahs in polite society. And they were the far minority of those things, but not unheard of at all. I didn't have thousands of cases, and then I had, you know, one of these. I had dozens of cases, and I had a couple of these happen. So it's far from unheard of for people to use our laws and the courts to punish people in their lives, and that there's seemingly little to no protection given. And, you know, speaking of men's rights, this is by and large something that's going to befall on men. What I mean by that is, if you look at who, you know, I know that, you know, more and more women are getting into firearms every day, but by and large, this is a male hobby, a male interest. And those are who the courts are going to be used against, to take their guns away. And I just think that, you know, if Republicans who are pro-gun want to get on the side of being able to say, hey, I'm not deaf to the demands of people who are looking for some quote unquote solution to this gun, you know, massacres that pop up and doing anything about them, they need to make sure that any red flag law they support has damn good protections, robust protections for the civil rights of gun owners, all down the line, from the initial onset, from granting the order to how those guns are seized, to how they're stored, to how and when they're returned. All that has to be in place, and none of it will be. This will be mm-hmm. anyway. There's my soapbox.
Well, look, first of all, there's this implication, because this issue is front and center now, that we don't already have red flag laws. We do. We do have red flag laws of various kinds in various states. And when due process is included in the red flag law, which is, you know, it must be included. There must be the ability to challenge
robust due process,
the decision. But I look at it a lot like what used to be called welfare, specifically aid to families with dependent children, which was a form of welfare that was always the most controversial because it provided perverse incentives for families to be separated. The intent was good. For people who didn't cheat the system, it worked. The problem was there was such massive fraud in the system that it became discredited. And that's the problem with all of these government programs. You provide more of something and you get more of it, right? You provide more incentives for the father to leave home and for the mother to not work, but stay home and live off the government. Then that's what they're going to do because people take the best deal available. And I think the problem here is the likelihood of abuse in this political climate, where it'd be too easy to accuse anybody of anything and haul them into court and hold some sort of, in reality, de facto political inquisition because somebody is a right winger and because they said something favorable once about, let's say, the Proud Boys. They're a danger to society, and they should have their guns taken away from them. I think it's like taking away family with dependent children. The intent is good, but it's so ripe for abuse because of the perverse incentives to abuse.
And it will be used politically, but even think about it apolitically. You're in a feud with your neighbor, the kid says from the household says, well, you better watch your back or, you know, we're going to be gunning for you. Or just some side comment like that in a normal world would not be seen as a threat to violence or an impetus for that family to lose their gun rights. But,
right. You
know, if this passes, if there were and this isn't federal legislation that's being contemplated, right. As I understand it, this is a money. This is a thing where they're going to provide massive funding for states. For the state level red flag laws. But if this was nationwide, Tim, within a week of it being live, there would be nationwide at least dozens and dozens of cases where Americans are losing their rights because of vendettas, because of child custody or other, you know, things. When I say robust due process rights in this measure, what I think needs to happen is court-appointed attorneys to argue on behalf of the person that the red flag law is being sought against at the moment the process starts. In other words, if you really want to protect the rights of people, they should have, you know, a former spouse goes and says, oh, I think that so-and-so should be red flagged. Well, right that moment, there should be a lawyer on both sides. Fine. If there's a lawyer for the government to say, okay, we're going to examine to say if we want to take this man's gun rights away, there should also be a lawyer there arguing on the other side, at taxpayer funded expense, because we can't have people have to defend against their, you know, maintaining their core Agreed. Rights.
100%. 100%.
So let's play. Yeah. This I thought was a very good clip by an author I know that you respect very much, and so do I, who authored More Guns, Less Crime. This is John Lott, about gun control, and where I think, you know, we all need to kind of reset the frame and go back to basics. So here's Professor Lott.
One thing that I find pretty powerful is that there's not one place in the world that's banned either all guns or all handguns that's seen murder rates go down or even stay the same. Every single time after you have those bans, murder rates, homicide rates go up. And, you know, there's a simple reason. And that is, you would think it would be a simple result if guns on net were bad. You'd think you'd find lots of places, you know, at least one, but surely lots of places where crime had gone down. But the problem is that when you ban guns, it's the most law-abiding good citizens who obey the ban, not the criminals. And to the extent that you disarm law-abiding citizens relative to criminals, you actually make it easier for criminals to go and commit crimes. And so, you know, and same with suicides. Like every place that bans guns, you'd think, given the claims that are out there, it'd be easy to find big drops in suicide rates. But people simply use other ways to go and commit suicide.
Yeah, in fact, many countries with very strict gun laws have much higher suicide rates than we have here in America.
Right. I don't like purely cross-sectional comparisons like that, because there's so many other things that vary. And, sure. You know, people can find things both ways. So, for example, gun control advocates will say, look at the UK compared to the United States. The UK has extremely strict, but yet they have a homicide rate that's much lower than the homicide rate that we have here in the United States. And my response to them is, that's true. But if you look before they had the gun control laws in the UK, they had even lower homicide rate relative to the United States. So it's still lower, but it increased relative to the United States after they put those types of bans in place that's there.
I didn't know about that UK stat, which I thought was instrumental. And by the way, for people listening, that other voice was Andrew Branca, who is Law of Self-Defense is his podcast where I got that from. I do recommend it. But that statistic that, you know, it's always talked about that, you know, the UK, the gun murder rate is lower there. And it's like, yeah, it is. And also it has risen with an increase in gun control. So in every instance, John Lott's data research says that when increases in gun control are in place, the law-abiding people, I mean, it is...
It's mere logic.
Yeah.
When you have two groups of gun owners, you have criminals and you have law-abiding citizens. When new laws are passed that make it more difficult to possess a gun, the law-abiding citizens are law-abiding because they follow the law, so they will comply. Criminals will not, because they're criminals, which means they don't obey the law. I mean, it's the logic. It's just so wrenching to try and explain that basic concept of human behavior. That's all it is, Scott. It's human behavior.
And the other thing that just, you know, this is somehow, I don't know why this doesn't penetrate or what the deal is, but you know, let's take an AOC, for instance, who will go on and on about how, you know, sort of poor brown populations are lesser than, they're not afforded government services. The government doesn't work for them and they're outside of who the government does work for. And especially in including police services, right? Mm-hmm. Who needs a gun more than a poor black person living in the hood? Yes.
Yeah. I mean, they're the ones they need. Black people need guns more than anyone else, period, because they're overrepresented in dangerous neighborhoods. Yeah. I mean, it's just that simple. Yes. I mean, you're taking it. That's your very constituency. I mean, I don't know how it's sort of like I say, how come Jewish people keep supporting Democrats who detest Israel?
We try
to figure it out. It's like, how can you support people who are in favor of gun control that will penalize the Democrats and the left's primary audience?
Yeah.
Black people.
Who needs the guns more? If you're, you know, rich whitey living in a gated community, you've got all the police protection that you need. All right.
Right.
Let's turn our attention before we go to the January 6 hearings. And it's incumbent upon me, Tim, to just take a moment and say once again that I was at the National Capital area on January the 6th, reporting live for LibertyNation.com. And people can go and see the reportage that we did there. And as an on-the-ground experience, I want to once again say, as I have multiple times on this podcast, that it is the upper-level staff and management of the JW Marriott Capitol Hill that are the real villains of this for how they treated the guests of that establishment, okay? And that I'm a victim.
And that I'm a victim survivor. Hearings.
I am a victim survivor of their treatment.
A victim survivor.
And you know, you mentioned Graham J. Noble earlier on this program. LibertyNation.com. What is his title? Just so I get it right here. Let's take a look at it. We don't want to screw that up. Chief political correspondent and satirist, and also bringer of distilled spirits, Tim, to the January 6th event that we were able to partake in. I just want to call him out for being the
you
hero.
You put the most important credential last.
For being the hero of that day for us for doing that. But in all seriousness, you know, I haven't tuned into it because it's so political. And just to prove, I think, how political it is, this was on Meet the Press. This is Elaine Luria, who is a Virginia congressperson. Listen to her on Meet the Press about who's going to be testifying and what in this search for the truth.
I want to ask about a specific witness, Cassidy Hutchinson, who's a special assistant to President Trump, was in the White House on January 6th. Is she helping to connect these dots and put and sort of plug the holes that you guys had on those 187 minutes?
It's a complex process to piece together. You know, you have 187 minutes, very few records. So, you know, everyone who has come to speak to the committee that has direct evidence of that time frame has been very helpful in piecing it together. I can't say that there's one person in particular.
Are we going to see her publicly, though?
We are still, you know, working on who our panel of witnesses will be. And there are several who have very direct and important information. So we will.
She sat with you for 20 hours. How many witnesses did you talk to that sat with you for 20 hours?
I'm not aware that there's any who, you know, provided quite that much time to our work and effort.
On the accusation that Scott Perry and other members of Congress sought pardons, the only name checked was Scott Perry. The other members of Congress, are we looking at one other or multiple others?
We'll be providing that information through the course of our presentations and our hearings upcoming.
Okay, but the allegation is out there. I mean, you guys have hard evidence that they requested these pardons?
We do.
And how many can you say? Is it more than two members of Congress?
I'm going to wait, and we will provide that as part of our information that we provide in the upcoming hearings.
Last question, and I'm curious of this. I think you guys, everybody in the committee has an idea of what happened. Who plays the role of devil's advocate on that committee hearing?
As far as, you know, during the hearing question?
During when you
I
guys
think
are...
I think we take turns, like, yeah. Everyone at different points, because people have different perspectives. And, you know, the fact that it's bipartisan, it kind of ping-pongs back and forth, you know.
That's great.
All right. So
that's great. And it is because it's bipartisan. Of course, we're getting these Republicans.
Yeah, Liz Cheney and
Adam Kinzinger. Yeah. Right? Yeah,
So that's the obvious part, right? It is preposterous. The notion that this is somehow bipartisan.
And it could have been.
It could have been.
That's
also,
the point. They had the goods on these people that committed these atrocities. on January 6th. But by strictly restricting Republican representation to the two most adamant, vehement Trump haters in Congress, they rob themselves of any credibility with everything that comes, because everybody knows that it's a show trial. It's what we call a star chamber.
So the first part of that clip, Tim, I don't think you picked up on it, but what I also wanted to have people focus on is, you know, Chuck Todd asks if this person is going to appear before the committee, and she slyly keeps the cards close to her vest. I don't even think she knows. I think it's being controlled by Pelosi and others higher up the food chain. But it's like, oh, well, we're not going to disclose. This is not a real, genuine expose of the truth. This is a campaign commercial. And that one little part gives it away, as far as I'm concerned. The idea that, oh, well, we're not going to tell you who's going to be up there and what evidence we expect to gather from them.
Right, because that's part of the second act or the third act.
We're going to reveal that. We're going to pull the curtain. We're going to pull the curtain on that when and how we think it benefits us and if we need it. And it is every bit, you know, I know that you don't need to hear that it's a political show trial, but it's being presented by the big box media like it isn't.
It's like a mid. It's really, isn't it like a mini series? You know, here's the prime time first. Here's the first episode in prime time.
Yeah.
Future episodes to follow.
Yeah, so they're going to adjust the script, and they're going to adjust the stars as they see fit to benefit themselves maximum politically. And I just want to say that, you know, there is no part of that that isn't designed to gain political gain from right. It has no, it's not a search for the truth. And it just pains me that it's being projected that way and being sold that way by the Democrat operatives with bylines in the big box media.
It's like everything they've done since they gained power in 2020. They've overreached in every single area. For example, I mean, you know, they barely hold Congress. They lost seats in the House. They barely control the Senate in a 50-50. And yet they come in with a Build Back Better plan that would pretty much destroy the economy. Inflation would be even worse. They came in with this because of their incredible overreach on a very narrow mandate in 2020. The only mandate was, we don't want Trump anymore. That's it. And yet they interpreted it as a permission concept to go ahead and be FDR and effect another New Deal. And they've been overreaching on everything from the moment they took power.
Now what I've noticed is there's this whiff in the air that they have been able to put out there that somehow Donald Trump did commit a crime or multiple crimes on January 6th. And whether we're going to have the courage to prosecute him.
You think they're going to prosecute him?
But they refused him to say whether or not they will. They will say everything mm-hmm. about this man being a traitor to the United States and all, but then asked directly if he committed a crime or should Garland, you know, move to prosecute him. All of a sudden, these people who are, you know, courageous to say anything, you know, in front of the world are reserved in this measure.
Right. Go ahead and listen to...
Okay.
Do you think he'll be indicted?
Listen to the clip.
That's up to the Attorney General.
We'll address that after you play this clip.
Okay.
I would like to see the Justice Department investigate any credible allegation of criminal activity on the part of Donald Trump or anyone else. The rule of law needs to apply equally to everyone.
Attorney General Garland is my constituent, and I don't browbeat my constituents. I think that he knows. His staff knows, the U.S. attorneys know what's at stake here. They know the importance of it. But I think they are rightfully paying close attention to precedent in history mm-hmm. as well as the facts of this case.
I think if anybody truly believed after what the attorney general says, for instance, after what every piece of information comes in, if you truly believe the election was stolen then, if the president truly believed it, for instance, he's not mentally capable to be president. I think he didn't believe it. I think the people around him didn't believe it. This was all about keeping power against the will of the American people.
You think his dereliction of duty was criminal?
You know, whether it's criminal or not, I'm not a, not a lawyer or judge. I thought it was wrong. And as a citizen, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, the American people have to judge this themselves, whether it's, you know, charging someone for a crime or not, but we have to judge it just from a political standpoint.
Even though I regret the way this commission is structured, the committee is structured, I'm not going to just dismiss it offhand. And certainly there was some very, very powerful testimony yesterday.
Do you regret voting against Pennsylvania?
No, because unfortunately, those two states did violate the Constitution by overturning election law without going through the legislative process, which is a violation of the Constitution. Those would not, the electoral votes those added up to would not have ever turned any election over, this election over. But I do believe election integrity is a legitimate issue and needs to, we need assurance going forward mm-hmm. for this democracy to work.
Well, I guess the only real news coming out of this would be if Trump was actually indicted, because most of the stuff they've brought up has been publicly available before. It's just being packaged into a mini series like we were discussing for consumption by the American people. But again, it's a missed opportunity because there's no question that if they had put some Republicans, even they should have put Jim Jordan on the committee, because what is Jim Jordan going to sit there and say when they show the most horrifying footage that's been cleverly added to make it look as bad as possible? What's he going to say? But if he's sitting there, or you have other Republicans other than Trump-deranged Republicans like Kinzinger and Cheney, then people will pay attention because they'll say, look, there's, you know, this is an actual hearing instead of an inquisition. But I think it is instructive for the American people, Scott, because now they can see the way things are done in communist countries, in the old Soviet Union, in today's Cuba. You have a predetermined outcome. You do not allow any dissenting testimony, and you bombard the nation with one side of a story. So if you want to know what things are like in a communist
first verdict,
country, look at the January 6th.
First the verdict, then the trial, Tim.
Correct.
Yeah. So the answer to your question is no, I do not believe that Donald Trump will be charged with a crime or indicted. And the reason why is if you can't even get Jamie Raskin to stand up and say, yes, he committed a crime and should be prosecuted for it, the idea that some, you know, Merrick Garland or one of his seconds is going to do that, I think is ridiculous. That
isn't it very this is a question, legal question. Isn't it very hard, as I understand, to prove incitement, which would be the most incitement to violence? Wouldn't that be the most likely charge that would go against Trump? And is it or is it not very difficult to prove?
It could be difficult. In this case, it's not difficult because there's no way, no how you could prove it. In other words, the idea that Donald Trump's statements that we're going to march down to the Capitol are an incitement to the riot and incursion on that building that happened is really, I think it's laughable for anybody who's not looking at this through a politically tinged glasses. If you just mm-hmm. remove the politics of it and you said to a law school class, person A says this, you know, group C did Y, is person A liable for incitement that group C did? No fair reading of the facts would indicate that that was true. You know, if there's some smoking gun, what Donald Trump said, go in there and beat the shit out of them and do whatever.
And they don't have
that. Fine. Then maybe yes. But that's not the case here. There's no suggestion that it's the case here. There is no evidence, Tim, of criminal incitement. And that's why Jamie Raskin and all those others don't say it, because it's not true. But the thing is, they have to keep it out there, right? So it's like, well, I'm not going to tell Merrick Garland how to do this. You're not going to tell Merrick Garland. You tell every attorney general how you want them to do their job. Why aren't you going to tell this one? Yeah. Well, because the answer is it would be politically inconvenient for them, these top Democrats on this committee, to say absolutely not. It's ridiculous to suggest that Donald Trump committed a crime. We just want to attack him politically.
This could really backfire because if they don't seek an indictment, I think Garland's going to come under fire and the party writ large going to come under fire from the left, from the progressive base that demands.
They already hate him. They already hate Garland. They can't stand Garland because he's not, for all his problems, he's better than Holder, for instance, who was a yes man and willing to commit crimes for Barack Obama. Merrick Garland seems to be a bit more circumspect in spite of his school board letter thing that we covered here and on the pages of LibertyNation.com. But he's not quite the company man that that they hoped for. So, all right, with that, we're going to leave it. And I suspect that we're going to have big news from the Supreme Court for next week. And we'll talk about a decision they made last week about the border searches by border officials, which didn't go unnoticed, but one of our biggest uprising fans sent me that article and kind of looking for comment about it. So we'll address that and other Supreme Court business next week. Tim, I hope I hope to see you then, Tim.
I will put it prominently on the calendar. Thank you, Scott.
Bye-bye.
That's it for this edition of The Uprising. Remember to hit Liberty Nation News for original articles, LN Radio, and our signature television program, The Conservative Five. Just go to LibertyNation.com on your browser or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for watching. This program is a production of LibertyNation.com. Conservative news where truth matters.
Contributor for LibertyNation.com.
I think we're starting to make an impact. Liberty style. Fight for freedom.
I'll be tracking polls sponsored by Liberty Nation for Thursday.
Mentioned by Dan Bongino, Rasmussen, Jordan Peterson, and others.
I can do it again if you want me to.
Cited in Mark Levin's American Marxism.
I think we're starting to make a real big impact. Getting noticed. We're doing it. Rock on. I'm gone.